Chapter 24, Next to Godliness. A few days later, when the sergeant had gone off to the side room to sleep and all was dark and quiet, something woke me up. It was a noise, the noise of a small creature in pain. It pulled at my heart, and I strained my ears to catch exactly where it was coming from. It sounded as if perhaps it was Busuku's cell. I decided to take a chance. If something were really wrong, it was worth the risk of trouble trying to find out. "Busuku? Busuku, are you awake?" I whispered. The little whining noises stopped, and all I could hear then was Busuku's labored breathing. "Busuku, are you all right?" I heard him shift around on the floor, but still no answer. I thought back to lunchtime. Busuku's boys seemed to be doing the cooking themselves, and sometimes they got a little free with the oil and chili peppers, but I didn't recall it being one of those days. "Busuku," I whispered once more, a little louder, "what's wrong? Is there anything I can do for you?" All right," he said, in a perfectly normal voice. "There is something you can do for me, Miss Friday." And then there was a mysterious pause. Thoughts flashed through my mind about what my mission might be. Digging through the wall between us to save him from some mortal injury? Breaking out of the back window to fetch help for him from town? "I need," he said with a tinge of embarrassment, I need you to tell me how to do the blasted Western stretch pose, you see. I sit down like you said to, and I stick out my legs, but I can hardly touch my knees, much less my toes. Is there some kind of trick to this? Come on, you can tell me. I promise I won't leak it out to anyone else unless I ask you first. I giggled despite myself. "Busuku, dear Busuku, what are you talking about? How do you know what I said about the back stretch pose? Do the walls of this place have ears?" "That they do," and I heard a smile in his voice. "I'm surprised you haven't discovered it yet. Now, let's see. Middle cell, Miss Friday, go press your ear to the wall about 2 feet up off the ground, say 6 inches from the corner where the poop hole is, and towards the front." I did just that, and my jaw dropped. I could distinctly hear snoring from the sergeant's room. I guessed as clear as if I were standing there myself. "Oh, Busuku, that's wonderful. I can hear the sergeant clear as day." "Odd thing, too, if you ask me," muttered Busuku. "He's been sleeping like a baby for weeks now. You'd think he was plumb out of money for liquor. But then, he's got your rugs to sell, and they bring in good money. I tell you, I haven't eaten this well in years." I smiled to myself again. "Ah, now that, Mr. Busuku, may be causing your feet to grow further away from your knees, you see." And I went on to give him a few tips about what could really help. Thus began our secret nighttime lessons together, and I was more careful with what I said to the captain in my other classes, knowing that our audience might be larger than I thought. After we'd finished giving and taking and the poses that week, I sat with the captain as usual to talk a bit. I'd thought of something I'd forgotten to say the week before. "Captain, there was something more I wanted to mention about the idea of focus. I wanted to make sure you understood clearly that focusing in a negative way, in a vain way, on your body as you get stronger and leaner would actually set you back in your progress." He nodded. "I understand, and you were right. It makes sense. It's one of those things you know by instinct is right, the moment you hear it." "Good, thank you," I replied. "But I also wanted to say that it's not vain at all to feel an honest happiness, a healthy sort of pride about the progress that you've made. And how good you really do look and feel when you're doing your yoga regularly. And good for good reasons, with the idea that you might help others. And then even when others see you and admire your progress, that's a good thing. You are fulfilling your goal of being an inspiration for them, to help them heal themselves. He nodded again, and I have to say that even his face was changing dramatically. His eyes had a crisp clarity about them, and his skin was gleaming. "And I was thinking, you know, about the difference," I continued, "because it's such a fine line, and we are all so weak, you see. And we can slip so easily from being honestly happy about feeling better in into thoughts of vanity and competitiveness. And it occurred to me that one thing to keep an eye on as we continue to make progress would be our feelings about others making the same progress. I mean, if we were doing yoga because we want to inspire others to do it too, so that they can heal themselves too, then if someone like the sergeant began to do yoga and suddenly got very good at it, able to do things we ourselves hadn't been able to do even after years of work, then I think our feelings about that would tell the story. I mean, if our motivation was pure, then we'd be excited and supportive. We'd let him know what a wonderful job he was doing. And if, on the other hand, we had started to slip into vanity, then I think we'd feel threatened somehow. We'd feel unhappy about his progress. And then that very basic disappointing form of dislike for someone would really start to choke our own channels and ruin whatever progress we'd been making. Do you see?" "I do see," said the captain frankly, "and I can tell you freely that my motivation, as always, was sort of mixed. A little hoping to inspire the men and also hoping that they'd be impressed with me." "I think all of us have that same problem," I mused, "and ultimately, it's the cause for all the ups and downs in our lives." He opened his mouth to start to ask a question, but somehow I sensed the right time for those particular ideas was still to come. Perhaps soon. "But what I already wanted to talk about today," I hurried on, "was an idea that lies behind the concept of focus, because you'll be able to focus even better. This yoga seems to unravel like an onion skin," laughed the captain. "Every time I think we've gotten to what lies at the bottom of everything else, you pull that layer off and show me another beneath it. Is there no idea at the very, very, very bottom?" And then when I answered later, he said it with me, like a chorus together, and we laughed. Anyway, here's something to think about when we're talking about focus and how it affects your channels and your inner winds. Normally, when someone tells us to focus, we have this picture in our mind of zeroing in on a thing, like a target. But if you really think about it, something else has to happen before the focus. I mean, you don't simply throw your attention out and hook the object you want to focus on just like that. Rather, there's a process of elimination, like walking up into a large group of people trying to find a friend of yours who's there. You don't just bump straight into him or her, usually. Usually it's a process you work through. You work through the crowd of people looking one way, then the other, eliminating groups and individuals as you narrow down the search for your friend. You arrive at where your friend is, really, by a process of weeding out where your friend is not. And focus, you see, it's the same. Even just focusing on a smudge on the wall as you hold a yoga pose involves gaining some awareness of your other surroundings and then tuning them out to arrive at your focus on the smudge. In the Master Short Book, this process is called withdrawing the mind from the outside world, to arrive at that clear pinpoint inner focus, which is so helpful for clearing the inner channels. He says it like this: "Learn to withdraw the mind from your physical senses. Freed from its ties to outer objects, the mind can arrive at its own real nature." And there are a lot of levels to withdrawing the mind from outer objects to weeding out extra objects in order to arrive at the one we really want to focus on. I gazed around the room. In fact, I can think of one very basic level right here in front of us. The captain glanced around, so accustomed to his office that he literally did not see what I was looking at. "This place," I said, waving my arms around to the old stacks of paper, the little piles of dirt everywhere, and the cups and bowls that or lying atop any open surface. "This place is a mess. Again, the captain looked around, a little more slowly this time. Then his eyes came back to mine with that look that says, "Doesn't matter much to me." Out loud, he said, "Does the fact that my office is, say, a little cluttered really have that much to do with my yoga?" "The master seems to think so," I responded, "because he says, the first commitment is to cleanliness." The captain looked unimpressed, but he had a good mind, and he wasn't afraid to think things out, so I knew it would work if I went through the whole explanation. "It all goes back to working on the channels from the outside." "Knocking on the pipes," he smiled, tapping the desk with his knuckles. "Right," I said. "And so far, we've talked about a number of things you can do from the outside, your body, which go down and affect the subtle winds on the inside. Things like yoga poses and breathing in very smoothly in a conscious way. And there's the constant interchange going on, you see, this constant interplay of the forces outside and inside you. You get frantic at work often enough, and it ties up the inner channels. That causes an injury, like your back. Actually, just a reflection of something going on deeper in the channels. That makes you grumpy, which tightens the choke points more. And then, because you don't feel well, you're not as careful about things, in general. And one of those things is, well, just simple neatness, tidiness. A lack of this very basic kind of cleanliness is almost a sure sign that your channels are untidy too. Deep down inside, the thought winds are jumbled up, ready to turn into new choke points at any time. And so a very simple and effective way to take advantage of the interchange, the interplay between outside and inside, is just to, I waved my arms around again, clean the place up. If where you live, if where you work, and especially if the place where you do your yoga poses is clean and tidy, then this is all reflected back upon the inner winds. I paused. And the channels loosen up and the poses work even better on fixing you and keeping you strong and healthy, finished the captain. And you see, something else is at work here too. If there's just less junk around the room, then when you go to focus and fix your mind on a single point, then there's not as many things that the mind has to sift through to get to what you want to focus on. It's a lot easier to find a friend in a group of 10 people, especially if they're all lined up, than in a crowd of 100 milling around. Less effort, much less effort to focus all day long. Focus is like food for the mind. The mind thrives on focus, and so do the good inner winds. And once you're done with your room, I said, you can go further. I mean, don't just tidy things up. Throw out absolutely as many things as you can. Half the things that fill up our houses at any given moment are things that we don't even use anymore at all. And a good part of the other half is things that we rarely use or don't really need to use. And these extra things in our house, you see, they're tricky. I mean, it looks like they're just sitting there, pretty harmless, and that's why we let them stay. But if I say right now, think of some of the things in your house, I paused again so he could do it, and he got sort of an odd look on his face, then you can remember a great many things lying around your house when you ever use them or not, whether you use them or not. And that proves, you see, that they are taking up part of your mind. You can remember them because information about each one of them is stored in your mind. And the mind, although we don't often think of it this way, has only so much capacity. Every time you acquire another object, every time there's one more thing cluttering up your home, then there's one more thing cluttering up your mind as well. And as the mind goes, so do the inner winds and the choke points in the channels. What you're saying then, observed the captain, is that the more unused, useless things I have lying around, the worse it is for my back and even my peace of mind because it hurts my channels? Just so, I said with a smile. And when you're done clearing out the extra things around your house, then you have to go on to your very way of life and do the same. Throw out extra things you do that you really don't have time to do well so you can focus. Throw out extra things you say that don't really need to be said anyway. Learn to be with your friends, a few good friends, in a happy sort of silence that you both understand and appreciate. Cut down on all the extra useless outside stimulation of your physical senses. Too much food, too much news, too much entertainment, too much physical gratification with the opposite sex. All of them fine in and of themselves, all of them healthy, but in moderation, in amounts that you can focus upon and enjoy deeply. And then the mind will be free to come inward and arrive at its own true nature. Concentration, contemplation, uninterrupted attention, medicine for the channels, medicine for the inner winds, and so for health and a happy state of mind that lasts. It's all a kind of cleanliness, in a way, tidiness on the outside, tidiness on the inside. The captain nodded, but his eyes were fixed upon somewhere over my head, and I knew his focus had wandered. And then after a moment, he snapped back. "Well," he said, his voice shaking a bit, "I guess that means I'll have to get to work and tidy up my home before what?" I asked, completely unaware of where he was going. "Well, before you come to visit next week," he smiled nervously. "For dinner," he added abruptly. Chapter 25, Two Invitations. I was still feeling rather stunned by the captain's invitation a full 3 days later when the corporal came up to the bars of my cell and handed me through a package wrapped in white cotton cloth, overtied with a string the way a man would do it. Captain says, Captain says you can wear this on Friday evening, but only if you really want to. Then the corporal blushed like a big boy and turned and went to the side room to hide for a while. I stooped in the other back corner, the one without the hole, with my back to the front of the jail, which was my version of privacy, and I set the little package on my knees. I worked carefully at the knots, string, you see, like all these normal little things you take for granted is something important and valuable to a prisoner. Time, on the other hand, is not. And so I carefully undid the knots and carefully smoothed out all the string before I even looked inside the package. It was an extraordinary piece of pale sky blue silk, the kind that an Indian woman would wrap around on a holiday, along with one of those beautiful matching tops. That evening, after dark, I tried the whole thing on. It fit perfectly. It was not new, but it was very clean, and I felt the care for it and the goodness of the woman whose dress it had been. And as much as I understood how extra things can distract us from our higher selves, it felt good and right to be dressed in something fresh and beautiful for going to the captain's home. It felt to me that something important was going to happen here, and it deserved this special kind of cleanliness. He had said to be ready by dusk at the appointed day. I dressed after doing my daily yoga session just before dawn, because the darkness was the last truly private moment I had every day. Then I wrapped my old ragged dress around the other for the rest of the day, despite the heat. I washed as well as I could with a cup of water in the afternoon, and then just waited around, well, nervously. And for some reason, both the sergeant and the corporal were standing around for hours, looking as nervous as little boys. And I could even feel Busuku being nervous in the next cell. I tried to sing the master's short book in my mind, like I do when I have to pass some time like that, but I kept drifting off even before the end of the first chapter. And what I figured was just about the moment before, I went into the back corner and got out a little dish with the last bit of the sergeant's ointment in it. My wounds were almost completely healed, and what scars there were seemed to be fading, but the sandalwood scent of the oil always lingered. And then he was there, dressed in a fresh white tunic with his captain's sash, and we went out in a surreal aura to the second room on the side. It had a small low desk with several mats around it, and thick dust-covered ledgers stacked against the wall. The corporal stood around nervously near the door while the sergeant rummaged through the ledgers and finally pulled out one, and then the captain said, "I want this done by the letter, Sergeant." And the sergeant looked up at him and then over to me, but with a face so free and unclean feeling that it's so free of any unclean feeling that it struck me like the fresh smell of the blue silk around me. And then he nodded, turned to an open page and made an entry, noting that a prisoner was being escorted from the jail by the captain on official business. And the captain signed his name, and the corporal came and pressed his thumb in some ink and made a mark that was his signature as an official witness. And the captain stood up very straight and looked at his two men very sincerely and said finally, "I am taking my teacher, Miss Friday, to my home because," and there was a long pause, "because I want to tell her," he paused again, looking into the sergeant's eyes, "tell her about what happened. What happened before. I think it will help. I think it will help all of us and the jail. It's just not the right place to say these things. Is it clear? Do you both see?" he asked. And they nodded as one, and we were gone, the captain and I, out the front door, across the porch, to the path, to the road. And there I paused and glanced behind us, and the captain smiled and said, "You are welcome to bring him too." And I ran back to the porch where the sergeant and corporal were standing, still gazing off at us like children left alone at home. The corporal was down the steps and back behind the building before I could say a thing, and he brought out my little lion on the rope and handed him over to me without a word. People were out to walk in the evening cool to buy their vegetables for dinner. A good number greeted the captain formally on the road and stepped aside to stare at Long Life and me. But all three of us were enjoying the air and the walk too much to notice them. His house was a beautiful little whitewashed bungalow standing by itself at the end of a road through some lovely green pastures. He showed me briefly around. It was simple, a small living room with a fireplace for cooking and a tiny pantry off to the side, a pretty little room for bathing and toilet, and a quiet bedroom with lots of windows facing a green hill on one side and a small valley on the other. He cooked and I watched in silence, enjoying the nightfall and the feeling of my little precious one in my lap. The captain knew what he was doing with the food, and it told me a lot about his upbringing. Subtle turns of spices, extra little stops along the way to let the savor set in. A well-off family, at least, but something else there too. He was a man who should have a fine wife and children, and two or three servants doing all his cooking. But he had obviously chosen to live like this. I was intrigued. We ate then, too, in silence. And it was not only that we really had only one thing, the yoga, in common with each other, but it felt as well that each of us was collecting our thoughts so we could speak of something of importance when the time came. And then it did. And he had poured out cups of a wonderful sweet spice tea, and he set everything else neatly to one side and sat before me with an earnest look. "There are things we need to speak of," he began. And there was no need to say more of it. We both knew. "I will be frank with you," he said. "There are things I need to ask. I will go straight to the matter. We cannot stay too long." I nodded, happy with my little lion and the prospect of important words. "You have fixed my back," he said, looking into my eyes with gratitude. "And if nothing else were said between us tonight, I would want to tell you how grateful I am. To be honest, I had simply expected to live with that, or worse, as I got older. And now, not only has the pain gone, but I feel somehow younger, lighter than I have in many years. not only physically, but here as well. And he laid his hand on his heart. I nodded again, sincerely, to thank him for his thanks. Gratitude, too, is one of the most powerful ways to free the middle channel. And then he looked out the back door, out over the beautiful little covered porch for a long, silent while, and then came back to me with his face. But you see, there is something very obvious I need to ask about this yoga. Perhaps it is so obvious to the people, but maybe they forget to ask, I think. I nodded. I felt something that was coming. His instincts really were so pure. You see, I know you fixed my back and part of my heart with the yoga, but I can't stop thinking. I can't help thinking about what it really means in the long run. I mean, let's face it, let's be honest. In the end, really, it doesn't matter so much about my back, I mean. And I know it will just keep getting older anyway, so no matter how the yoga poses may help in their way to delay it or help me make the best of what I have left as I grow older and older, but sooner or later, something else will get hurt, and sooner or later, something else will fail, and sooner or later, no matter how much energy the yoga gives me, my total level of energy will drop, is dropping, even as we speak, year by year, and then one day, you and I both know it, and no matter how disciplined or determined I may be, well, one day, I will stop the yoga, because it just won't be able to do it physically, and then I'll die, as all of us must die, and I'm not sure then what doing the yoga will have meant. It almost seems as though it will have been fruitless by the end, you see. And he paused and looked at the ground, and I knew he wanted to say something more, to tell me something. It's not that I'm not grateful, you see, he said finally, almost in an apology. But there are reasons why I ask this thing. There are reasons, good reasons, reasons I cannot escape for asking you about these things. And with that, finally, he stood and he went to the mantelpiece over at the fireplace and brought down a folder made with lacquered wooden covers. And he opened it and handed it to me. Inside, there was a single piece of yellowed paper, a drawing, a portrait. It was a girl with long, beautiful black hair and eyes curving gracefully up, like the eyes of a Tibetan woman, very much like mine. I realized, my own eyes. Then something began to dawn on me, and I looked up at him suddenly. I did not want to marry, you see, he began, his voice choked with emotion, and then it poured out of him. I wanted to stay with Uncle, you see. He was everything to me. We lived further north of here, you see, where the hills begin beneath the mountains that connect your people's land to ours, the Himalayas. And Uncle, you see, he was different. You had to walk a long way across the face of the highest of the hills just to reach his house, his little hut, a stone hut. You see, he was there, he lived there alone, so he could do his yoga, you see, like you. And he did it the old way, like you, like you're showing me, you see, not just the poses by themselves, but with the sitting, silently, and with the master's short book, you see, the very same book. And he began to show me things, like you do, with the breathing and the focus. And he even began to teach me the letters of the mother tongue of Sanskrit, you see, and that is how I could read just the cover of your book, you see, and that is how I understand how I feel what you say when you say it. But Father, you see, and the sadness grew deeper in his face. Father was afraid. Father was so proud of me, so proud to have a son at last, and so afraid when he saw how close I was growing to Uncle who it seemed did nothing with his life, although even then, you see, I knew, I felt that it was only Uncle who was not doing nothing with his life. He paused, remembering, almost unaware any longer of my presence. He looked into his tea, sipped it without thinking, and went on. So Father, you see, he arranged the marriage as early as he could. And we married. And then to make sure, he sent us away to the capital. He found me a job in the court, you see, in the king's court. And those were the days of trouble and the days of opportunity, you see. It was just 3 years after the old king had died, and there had been a terrible struggle afterwards, and some noblemen had taken power, done something to the queen mother and to the crown prince, the older prince, you see, killed them or sent them off into slavery in the western lands. But the year Father sent me to the court was the beginning of the new realm, and the younger prince, who had escaped and returned with a strong army of his father's old allies, and they put him back on the throne. But they couldn't stay nearby forever, and it was a difficult time for the new king, you see. He needed good people, new people, and my father, he got me in. He got me into the ministry, you see, the ministry of justice, and I could read, I could write our local language, and I worked hard. And within a year, the superintendent, same one who is superintendent now, the one in charge of us, he noticed me and he brought me up close to him, and he was close to the new king because he had been very close to the old one, and they had studied together some of the things that uncle had studied, and even with the same teachers. And that is how I was able to come to the capital and begin my rise at the court. And she was beautiful, as you can see. She was good. She respected the deeper things, you see, the things that uncle had taught me to care about. And we set up our home in the capital there. And it was a beautiful home, a home of simplicity and grace and hope. And near the end of that first year, we conceived a child. All our hopes, they were being fulfilled there before our very eyes. He stopped abruptly and looked down quickly at the floor, and his face twisted into itself and tears sprang down his cheeks. And when it came time for the child to be born, well, she labored and she fought and she screamed and she bled to give the life. But in the end, it was born our girl. She was born dead. And the effort to give her that birth of death, it killed her too, you see. And I was left alone with two dead bodies in that beautiful home of hope. And he stayed there weeping and weeping without moving for a long time. And Long Life felt it too, the way he does feel things deeply. And he got up out of my lap and went and put his head on the captain's knee. And without thinking, the captain stroked his fur, and in a while, he was able to go on. And that was when I began to drink, you see, because it hurt so much, and nothing meant anything to me anymore. And at first, I would come work late, and then I began to miss days and more days because it felt like really there was not a lot of reason to get up out of bed in the morning. And then finally I began to drink in the daytime too, even in the morning, and I came to the office like that. And the superintendent, he tried, he really did. He was so close to uncle in his way of thinking, and such a generous man anyway. And he cajoled and covered and finally punished me however he could think of to get me out of it, but it was hopeless. And he and the young king, you see, they still had enemies. They still have enemies, even now, in the court and in the ministry, people who would like any excuse to be rid of them. So in the end, he had no choice, and he sent me here, to this godforsaken little town on the border. I have no idea why this one in particular, except that it was so forgotten by everyone that whatever mistakes I made while I was drinking myself to death here would go unnoticed. And Ravi was here, the sergeant. He was a good man. He was still a good man. And those were good days, you see, at the beginning. Ravi took me in and got me excited about cleaning up the gangs of hoodlums that were terrorizing the lives of the people in this town all day long. And clean them up we did. Those swords and pikes on the wall at the station were not always rusted and dusty, you see. We fought hard and we drank hard. And here he stopped again and stared sadly at the floor. And Ravi, you see, Ravi, he didn't drink before I came. He was a good man, a family man, and a good officer. And then it was me who started him drinking. First for fun, to celebrate the thrill and danger of our victories, and later for boredom. And later on, for the sheer pain he was in because of... And here the captain stopped cold and wouldn't allow himself to go on. We were silent again, and he rubbed Long Life's ears absent-mindedly. And then, when the last thing happened, you see, I stopped. I had to stop, knowing I had been the cause of it all. But he couldn't, because the pain was always there right in front of him, and he still stops from time to time, but then the pain comes back on him hard for some reason, and he starts again. And even then, you see, he stopped dead again, looked me hard in the eyes. Even then, even if our dream came true, even if all the silent sitting and seeing myself taking away his pain and his drinking, even if it worked, you see, even if it came true, and even if giving him the most precious thing I have left in my life could really happen, even if somehow he became captain, even then, I'm not sure deep inside me what it would all mean, what it would mean in the end. And he placed his hand sadly on his wife's likeness. If it all has to fall apart again anyway, if a sober and successful sergeant or captain has to go through the degradation and humiliation and travesty of that gradual fall into old age and weakness and the loss of all that we hold dear, and then death itself, regardless of whether we do yoga or not, what would it mean? He pleaded. What does it mean? My instincts told me to stay silent. There was still something there in him to come. And again, he lifted his eyes past me and stared out the door, past the porch, into the dark, and then came back to my eyes, strong and clear now. I said I wanted to speak honestly and to speak openly with you, and I have. But there is one more thing. You see, Uncle, when I was young, just a boy really, he didn't just teach me the beginning yoga poses and some exercises with the breath and focus and letters and all that. Sometimes, when we were sitting there, like this, in the evening, alone, over a warm cup of tea, his root tea, you see, then he would look out into the dark of the sky, stretched over the plains beneath us, over all of Mother India before us, and he would talk about wonderful things, about, and the captain paused a bit, seeming embarrassed, about, you see, people who had learned all the yoga, the deeper yoga, the yoga of the master's short book. And Uncle said, you see, he said, if you had a good teacher and you really tried with all your heart, then you could go to heaven, you see. I mean, what they always talk about, it could really happen to you, to anybody at all, no matter what your age or whether you're a man or a woman, rich or poor, successful or not, you could really one day meet angels, beautiful, holy creatures, and you could learn to be with them, to stay with them, and you could even yourself change one day and be like them, made of pure light, passing through every realm of living things, man and beast, constantly helping them, constantly nurturing them, like your own children, and then one day make them like you, angelic, indestructible light, perfect love, spreading to every living creature in need and curing them. And I was young then, too young, and I bore the curse of youth. I had health, I had strength, I had not seen death or tragedy. I was sure I was immune to them in any event, and I simply didn't hear what he was saying. But the seed, you see, the seed was planted. And then a vision of what could really be, a vision of what the word yoga really means, a union with things divine. And the seed stayed with me all the time. And then when you came to me and you looked so much like her or perhaps our daughter, and exactly the same age she would have been, but either way, like an angel, the way I know an angel would look to me, like them. And then when we opened the master's book and you read that line about how we think things will last when they never do, well, in that moment, the seed broke open in me, you see, and hope came to me. Hope for things, the things like Uncle spoke about, because he said, too, that when angels came and he began to reach them, as we begin to become them, all the ones we love too, all the ones we have ever loved and ever will love, they come. He said they all come. He said they come and we are together. And that's the real yoga. This was the real reason for every part of yoga, whether it is the yoga poses or breathing, or focus or the sitting. And all I ask you tonight here is it possible? Can it really work that way? Can we go beyond death and old age like this? Is it a way to heaven? Is there a heaven? Do we meet angels? Are there angels? Can we become like them, light and pure love? Can we learn to make others that way too? And will we all be in the end together like that? Do you know these things? Can you? And then his voice broke into a sob and his head came down nearly to the floor before me. Can you, will you teach me these things? A power came into me, a power like the power that Katrin had. And I put my hand on his head and I held it there softly, warmly, touching the seed in him, making the hope grow real. And I gave him silence so he could feel it and never forget it. And then I said softly, all the things your uncle said, all those things, they are true. The master too says, and there will come a time when they invite you to take your place with them. He looked up quietly now, and I looked down at him. You are invited, I said gently, with words that were not my own. And now the real work begins. Chapter 26, Flesh or Light. At our next class, the captain fairly dragged me to his room. He was excited like a little boy, far cry from the tired, grumpy office worker I had met on the first day. Questions, he exclaimed, lots of questions. I've been thinking about everything. Then he stopped suddenly and looked at me with a touch of worry in his face. But something else first, something else we have to talk about. I nodded simply and went on. You see, wherever we go from here, I have to say first, I have to admit that you have cured my back, and you obviously know what you're doing with the yoga, especially with yoga in the broader sense, from channels to breath to mind to heart and further. He looked up with anticipation. And so really, we both know that the book is really yours and that you cannot have stolen it. And regardless of what the sergeant said all along, and then he paused, I raised an eyebrow. Said all along? I asked. The captain reached out and toyed with the pen on his desk nervously and then said with a slightly puzzled look on his face, well, you see, the sergeant, didn't you ever notice or wonder why he was out at that little guardhouse at the checkpoint on the day you came through? Have you ever seen him or the corporal ever go out to man that crossing gate again during the whole time you've been here? And then it dawned on me what he was saying. No, I hadn't wondered, and I really should have. I looked back at the captain, puzzled. Well, it was about a week before that, you see, and the sergeant, he comes to me and he tells me that he's gotten word from some informant, some unnamed informant, that a girl matching your description, a foreigner from Tibet, accompanied by a dog matching his description, and the captain waved in Long Life's general direction, is going to be attempting to cross the borders of the realm carrying contraband, some kind of stolen articles, and that we should post a guard there on that particular road to intercept her. My mouth dropped full open. I tried to remember if I had met anyone on the road before that who could possibly have gotten such an idea and sent word ahead. And so, the captain was speeding on, and so you can't really blame me for being so careful with you. But now, of course, now it's all so obvious, just a terrible error of some kind, and you really should be released. I sat back a little stunned, and he glanced up and then down and then hurried on. Except that, you see, we can't really release you. His eyes came up again, but I didn't really feel much either way, to tell you the truth. My thoughts were elsewhere, on the class, on the place we would start today. Don't you want to know why not? He exclaimed. Sure. All right. Yes. Please. I said, coming back to myself. Well, you see, on the day that you tried to escape, I shot him a fiery glance. I should say, on the day that it seemed like you tried to escape, I wrote a report. I was required to write a report, you see, informing the ministry that we had in custody a foreigner who had attempted to escape. And now, you see, you are on record. And the ministry people, they are especially careful with foreigners, given the delicate situation between the queen, the king, and the various other factions. There's no way I could release you now. No way I could report it as a simple mistake without causing a lot of trouble and accusations aimed at the superintendent by his enemies in the ministry, who would see any correspondence I sent in. And so we will have to wait. Wait? Wait for what? I asked. For the superintendent himself to come, you see. And then I can explain everything in person with no correspondence. As I told you, he received some training in the ways of yoga as far back as the time of the old king, who at one point even had an illustrious teacher of yoga advising him. The superintendent will understand. He will give us approval to release you, and then he'll be able to deal with the people in the ministry when he returns. So when will the superintendent be here? I asked. But strangely, I was more engrossed in thinking about how to guide the captain through the pathways of ideas just ahead of us. That's a bit of a problem, you see, he replied. The superintendent, well, he makes it a point to visit every facility like this in the realm at least once a year. The once a year struck me, and suddenly it sounded to me that I should perhaps listen to what the captain was saying. Or so, continued the captain, who had at least mastered official vagueness during the time in the capital. You see, he explained, it is frankly dangerous for the superintendent to announce the itinerary for his visits, since the countryside roads would be a perfect place for people of different factions to ambush him. He is also very strict and dedicated as a leader, as was the old king, his friend. He demands regular reports of all of our border skirmishes and such, and he likes his visits to be a surprise so he can really see how we work day to day. All your border skirmishes? I asked. And here the captain reddened a little bit. Then he sat up straight and gestured to the piles of reports stacked around him. The people in the ministry, not the superintendent, you see, but many of the people who work around him, people who would like to see him and his ideas thrown out along with the young king, they would never allow this station to exist if they didn't think we were actively holding off constant incursions from the other side of the border. And if this station didn't exist, then the gangs would be back herding people here within a few weeks, and all the work we have done to make them safe would be lost forever. And so you see, I make up the skirmishes, and then I write the reports, and then, you see, it keeps the common people of this town safe, something that the factions so influential in the ministry couldn't care less about. Suddenly I grasped something important. And then the captain's path to what he really dreamed of, his path to the dream his uncle had given him, became clear. Ah, I said, beginning him down the path. So now I see, I said, waving at the stacks of report. The captain looked puzzled. You see, Why you may have to stay inside this jail for months and months, maybe many months more, you see? Inside, I replied distractedly. Why, oh, whatever, of course I have to stay here. We decided that when we spoke at your house or before, I said flatly. But no, that's not what I mean. I mean that now I see how your back was cured. My back? He asked, reaching around instinctively to where he had held it all those years. Why, it was the yoga, of course, the exercises, And I'm sure the silent sitting and the good wishes for the men, that helped too. I mean, you know, loosening the choke points and all that, knocking on the pipe from the outside, cleaning it out from the inside, inner winds and all that. You see, I know why my back got better. I shook my head. That's not why your back got better, I said with finality. That's just how your back got better. What I just understood was why your back got better. And until you understand why your back got better, you won't even understand really how your back got better. He looked at me a little confused. That was all right. Learning these things takes some time to get all the explanations, some time to ask your questions, some more time to get them answered. And now we would start. I mean, I said, it's something we began to talk about a long time ago. Lots of people have aches and pains, things that come to all of us more and more the older we get, he nodded. And people try different things to stop the aches and pains, and a certain number of people end up trying yoga and the yoga exercises, the poses. And you see, let's put it bluntly, the yoga works for some of them and it doesn't work for others. And even with the people it works for, it stops working at some point, and they get older. And then they just get older and eventually die, like everyone else. We said all this before. But the channels, he objected, the inner winds, you explained everything. Yoga works for you if you know how to use it on the channels, on the choke points, from the outside and the inside. Not enough, I said, not enough. We have to go deeper. He gave me a look that said he didn't really want to go deeper. He felt all right today, and going deeper, it was an effort that we all avoid in our own way until life forces us forward, or unless we have a teacher to drag us there. Think, I said finally, think. You have to think about it now. It's not just the sergeant and the corporal, and you know it. Now it is the wonderful woman whose blue dress I wore that night. Now it is the daughter you made with her, together. It's time to ask, time to find out. It's not fair to them, it's not fair to ourselves to just go on quietly with what little we understand, incomplete, until it's too late for us to help ourselves or anyone else. What made the channels? What put the winds inside the channels? Why does the wind decide to turn one way and not the other? Why do we decide to turn one way and not the other at every fork in the road of our lives? What really brought you to this town? What brought me here? Why have we met? Why did you hurt your back? Not how. And this particular little desk, why did it get better? Why did your back get better? And could we go further? Could we change your body altogether? Does it need to be this way? It is all of the questions you asked me the other night, and now we need to answer them. And you have to follow me and think hard and work hard. There are so many lives at stake, so many. If what your uncle said was true, do you see? We need to ask and we need to work hard. It doesn't matter that we are inside a jail. Everyone is inside a jail. We need to get out of the bigger jail, this entire life, this life that always leads to death and ruin. He looked up at me with hope, but then shook his head. You gave me hope, you give me hope every time you speak like this, but then when I am alone again, I start to think. And the first thought that comes is always the same, and it always stops all the other thoughts that might have come after it. I waited for the question I knew was coming. A person who didn't think to ask it first was not a worthy vessel for the knowledge the captain sought, the knowledge of life itself. You see, he said, you can talk of deeper causes. You can talk of how the body really works. You can talk of some miraculous method of changing it at the deepest levels. You can even talk quietly, in the stillness of our most private thoughts, about changing the body forever, of going as light itself to live in a place of light among beings who are pure light and love. He paused to calm himself and gazed for a moment out the window. But whatever you say, however inspiring your words might sound in the moment, one cold fact remains. And it kills your words. It has always killed those words for me, and always will, until I learn better. What I mean to say, he uttered finally, is that aside from stories and myths and old tales we hear repeated now and again, never anything that you could prove, never anything that you could actually see, well, no one that we can meet face to face has ever really changed like that. Like what you spoke about. I mean, no one that we actually see has ever used the wonderful methods you speak of to change into light, to go to a place of perfect and never-ending happiness, and to stay there with the ones they love, with the ones they loved, as you and Uncle, claimed we could do. And then he closed his mouth into a thin, tight, sad line and stared at me, almost in accusation. And it is the first question, and it should be the first question. And I had taught him the answer already. He knew it already, but it was just too immense, really, to keep his mind on that for too long. The Master says, I began, that we must stay in that one pure thought and never forget it, that single most important thing. Things are empty of being what they are by themselves. He shook his head tightly, forcefully. He almost saw, but then didn't see, and it was killing him. I picked the pen up from the desk and held it between us, my shining golden sword. Is this a pen, or is it something to eat? I demanded. He shook his head again. I leaned over intensely and slammed the pen into his chest. Is this flesh born only to die, or is it pure and loving light? He looked up at me, his face changing. And your wife and your daughter, I said loudly now, thrusting my palm there at his chest where the high compassion lies. Are they dead and gone forever, or do they stand at your side waiting to be seen, waiting until you learn to see them, learn to be with them, to be them? And then I slammed my hand down again on the desk and held the pen up between us. Is it a pen or something to eat? Answer me. A pen, he screamed back, nearly across the border. A pen. No, I screamed back. Not a pen. Never a pen. Never a pen. No cow has ever seen it as a pen. And so, I waited for him. And so, they would say, cows would say there are no pens. He finished, still thinking it out. The mind makes it a pen, he went on to himself. It's not a pen by itself. It's empty of that by itself. And then he looked down at his own chest where my hand had woken him. And the body, my body, this flesh, he said, holding his own two hands there with a look of wonder growing on his face. It is flesh. It is flesh because and only because my mind makes me see it this way. Then his chin jolted upright and his eyes burned into mine. But how to change it? He breathed. And I nodded at his understanding and said, it is what I have to teach you now.